Welcome to this 11KBW podcast on GDPR and information law update by Timothy Pitt-Payne QC. This talk was given at the 11KBW Local Authority Conference on 24th of September 2019 at the Turing Lecture Theatre in London. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
It's always difficult doing a conference presentation on a day when there is an eagerly awaited court decision which is being released that very morning. Of course, what I'm referring to is the decision of the CJEU in the Canil against Google case, which everybody has been waiting for today. I understand that there was some other Supreme Court decision out today as well. I think it's a case of slipping something out when it's not going to be noticed against the background of the day's big story. As I'm sure everybody is aware, for some years now, we have had, since the Google Spain case, we've had the right to be forgotten as a feature of data protection law, and we've had the possibility of people applying to delist internet search results about them so as to exclude particular items. And we've had a number of cases about that delisting remedy. And the question in the Canil case was when an EU regulator takes regulatory action, in that case against Google, in relation to the right to be forgotten, should the remedy that's given be an EU-wide remedy, or should it be a worldwide remedy? The Canil, the French equivalent of the ICO, had wanted to impose a worldwide remedy on Google in relation to a right to be forgotten case, so an obligation to delist search results in relation to all of Google's activities worldwide. The CJEU this morning has said, no, that's too wide. EU-wide, yes, but Google wasn't required to go beyond that. I've had a quick look at the decision. At the moment, it's only available online in French, and my schoolboy French is somewhat rusty. So that's the best I can do at the moment by way of summary. Turning then to the five things which I was intending to cover in the paper this morning. First of all, in relation to data breach. Secondly, in relation to facial recognition technology. Thirdly, in relation to situations where you have multiple data controllers involved in the same processing. Fourthly, some procedural changes. And there's a fifth thing which isn't in that summary on the first slide, which is a couple of mentions of some recent data protection cases. Now, in relation to data breach, this, of course, is the worst case scenario for data controllers, including for local authority data controllers, that there's a data breach potentially giving rise to regulatory consequences in relation to the ICO, which may involve an enforcement notice or a money penalty, and then also potentially giving rise to civil liability, civil claims. And there are a number of scenarios in which those difficulties can arise for data controllers. One scenario is the attack by bad actors from outside the organisation. You get hacked. Or secondly, an example which I'm going to say a bit more about in a moment, the case of the senior employee who goes rogue and deliberately leaks personal data in order to damage the organisation. In a local authority context, I've seen, I think, two factual patterns which arise from time to time in relation to data breach. One is the situation where the authority is hacked from outside. And the problem situation there can be where the hack has potentially exposed large quantities of information some of which may be highly sensitive information, e.g. in relation to the authority's child protection work. And the problem with that sort of incursion can be that very often it will be done in such a way that it is difficult for the authority to work out, firstly, whether any data has in fact been exfiltrated, taken out of the authority's sites, and secondly, if it has been, whether it's been disseminated and how widely it's been disseminated. Another scenario is the situation where information is accidentally disclosed by the local authority in relation to specific individuals, but in such a way as to put the safety or well-being of those individuals at risk, leaving them in a situation where they have to take expensive steps to protect themselves, e.g. they may need to change identities or move house or something of that nature, and then the authority can find itself on the receiving end of a substantial data breach claim for financial loss, together with a claim for distress. So that's some standard cases where data breach issues, I've seen them arising in relation to local authorities. I think a fear that has been commonplace for many data controllers is the fear of being faced with group litigation as a result of a mass data breach. And the concern there is that even if each individual claim is not worth a great deal of money, say in the hundreds or the low thousands of pounds, if you have enough claimants, the total exposure may be very significant. And the risks are accentuated by the possibility, firstly, that there may be group litigation on a no-win, no-fee basis. In other words, the potential recovery in aggregate is sufficient for a claimant law firm to be willing to take a punt on the claim. It may also be sufficient to attract the interest of litigation funders. So the question is, how real are those risks? And I think the risks have been something that's been the subject of discussion since the Vidal Hall case under the old data protection law, which established that there was a potential for claims to be brought solely on the basis of distress, no financial loss. There are still problems for litigation funders trying to get mass data breach claims off the ground. One is the difficulty of working out what is the quantum of each individual claim, and is that enough to make the economics of group litigation worthwhile? And secondly, what's the additional cost of recruiting each individual claimant? Because unless the expected recovery for each individual is substantially greater than the cost of recruiting each new individual, the economics of the claim are not likely to make sense. And I want to say a bit about two cases which cast some light on these risks in relation to mass data breach litigation. One is the Morrisons case, and the other is Lloyd versus Google. The Morrisons case is in general bad news from the point of view of data controllers. The Lloyd against Google case is, I think, quite good news for data controllers. So the position is overall is quite finely balanced. Morrisons, I suspect, the facts of that case will be familiar to a number of individuals. This is a situation where a senior employee goes rogue. So you had a senior employee who had access in the course of his work to very substantial quantities of personal data, payroll records for some 100,000 employees. He had access to that information because he needed to share it with the company's auditors for the purpose of the company's annual audit. Because he had a grievance against the company in relation to a quite unrelated matter, low-level disciplinary action that had been taken against him, He sought to take his revenge on the company by putting that information into the public domain on the internet in order to damage the company. He was prosecuted and he was convicted of an offence under the Fraud Act, and he was sentenced to a substantial term of imprisonment. The Information Commissioner's Office took the view that the data controller was not at fault and took no regulatory action. Of the 100,000 people who'd been affected by the data breach, some 5,000 were claimants in a group action organised under a group litigation order. The question of liability has been determined and has got as far as the Court of Appeal, and the decision on liability at first instance upheld in the Court of Appeal was that Morrisons were not liable themselves for a breach of the data protection legislation, but they were vicariously liable for the senior employee's own breach. So, two theories of the case. Did Morrisons themselves breach the data protection legislation? Answer, no, they didn't, because their own information security measures were adequate. In particular, they had no reason to think that this particular senior employee might go rogue. So who did breach the data protection legislation? Well, the senior employee himself did. When he took control of that information and chose to make it public, he was a data controller in relation to the information at that point. What he did was in breach of the data protection legislation. That breach was committed in the course of his employment, crucial step in the reasoning, and so Morrisons were vicariously liable. The case is going to the Supreme Court early in November, where Anya Proops, QC of Chambers, will be acting on behalf of Morrisons. There are some very significant areas of uncertainty in relation to that litigation, particularly in relation to Quantum. One obvious case is, would the outcome be the same under the new legislation, the GDPR combined with the Data Protection Act 2018? My view is yes. I struggle to see how there is anything in the new legislation that would put a data controller in a better position than they are under the old legislation. More encouraging from a data controller point of view is the decision of Mr. Justice Warby in the Lloyd and Google case. The significance of that is that it was a rather innovative attempt to make mass litigation in data breach cases procedurally easier, and it didn't work. It arose out of something that Google had done, something called the Safari Workaround, which effectively enabled them to collect data about users of the Safari web browser without those individuals knowing it, and then monetize that data, use it for marketing purposes. So very different from anything, of course, that a local authority might do. But I think the point that is of local authority relevance is the procedural steps that could be taken to try and turn that into a piece of group litigation. In theory, what you could have done is try and recruit lots of individual claimants, get a group litigation order, bring a group action, exactly what was done in the Morrisons case. Difficulty with that, highly expensive, so the approach that was taken for the claimant instead was to have a single claimant suing on a representative basis on behalf of everybody who was affected by the data breach. And that didn't succeed. Mr. Justice Warby had to consider whether the claim was viable, because permission was needed for service out of the jurisdiction in order to start it. He said it wasn't, and he said that was for two reasons. First of all, he said there wasn't a viable damages claim that had been formulated, because the case theory was that every single individual who was affected by the data breach should be entitled to a sum, regardless of any individual distress that they could show, purely and simply to mark the fact that there had been a breach of their personal data rights. Mr. Justice Warby disagreed. He didn't think that that was an available head of damages. So one message there seems to be, if Warby is right, that what you need to show from a claimant point of view is some individual loss going beyond the mere fact that your data protection rights have been breached. It might not be a money loss, could be distress, but it has to be something more than the mere fact of a breach. And secondly, he said this wasn't viable to be pursued as a representative action because the representative claimant didn't have the same interests as all of the members of the affected class. Effectively, every individual would be affected by this breach in different ways and would have their own different interests in relation to the breach. So that was an innovative but so far, so far unsuccessful attempt to make it procedurally more easy to bring a mass data breach claim. So I think in terms of data breach litigation, where we've got to is that mass data breaches still give rise to a wide range of risks for data controllers. But on the other hand, the rather apocalyptic scenarios that people were coming up with after the Vidal Hall case 5 years ago about how any mass data breach would inevitably lead to a massive civil action for damages. So far, that hasn't really taken off. I stress the words so far. Moving on then to a very recent case, a couple of weeks ago, from South Wales, the Bridges case. This was a case about the use of facial recognition technology in a pilot project. And it's a very interesting example of the GDPR and Article 8 and the 2018 Data Protection Act all being brought to bear on something that is technologically novel. So this was the South Wales Police trying out facial recognition technology. What they were doing was they were looking for individuals who would match their list of persons of interest, in effect, a wanted list or what they called a watch list. So they had CCTV cameras set up at public events or in busy parts of town. And they captured CCTV images. When those images were captured, a biometric analysis was then carried out of those faces on an automated basis, and they looked for a match against the wanted list. And if there was no match, then the biometric analysis was immediately discarded, so it would be kept for a very short period of time. The claimant was somebody who said that his image had been caught, had been recorded by the pilot, but he hadn't been matched against the wanted list. Two questions. First of all, did this involve an unlawful interference with his Article 8 privacy rights? Secondly, did it involve a breach of data protection legislation? In terms of Article 8, the court accepted that Article 8 was engaged. It was argued that the interference was effectively de minimis because the biometric analysis of the claimant's face would have been discarded almost straight away. The court said, well, carrying out that kind of analysis, which enables you to identify somebody with a high level of precision on an automated basis, carrying that out in itself engages Article 8. But in terms of the Article 8 two questions, the court held that the interference was in accordance with law and proportionate. It was in accordance with law because there was a detailed framework of both law and policy that would govern the interference. In terms of the framework of law, one was looking at the data protection legislation, including the 2018 Act and the GDPR. In terms of policy, there was a whole raft of publicly available policy as to the way that the police used information. So, in accordance with the law, what had been argued for the claimant was this couldn't be in accordance with the law because there wasn't any specific legal provision that said the police can use facial recognition technology. And so the claimant was saying you need to be able to point to some specific facial recognition powers to justify the police in using this technology. The court said no. The legal basis for what the police did here was their common law policing powers, which are were wide enough to enable them to adopt this novel technology. So a very important message there. When a data controller, in this case the police force, uses a piece of new technology, they don't necessarily have to be able to point to some specific legal power that relates directly to that particular technology. So in the police case, broad common law policing powers were sufficient. And then when it came to proportionality, although the court was very clear that Article 8 was indeed engaged here, they were also clear that the level of interference with individual rights was relatively low, and the policing rationale in favour of using this technology was a robust one. So the claim failed under Article 8. What about under data protection? It's quite an interesting pattern when you see these big cases which are argued both under Article 8 and under data protection, that quite often you see the court spending most of its energies on the Article 8 analysis, and once it's got through that, then wanting to get through the data protection analysis quite quickly, i.e. with a sense that if it's okay in Article 8 terms, data protection law shouldn't hold it up. In this case, there was rather more of a careful analysis of the data protection side than one often sees in this kind of case. And there were a number of quite interesting questions there. The first one was, did this exercise involve the processing of personal data? And what was said for the police is, well, it didn't, because when they used this facial recognition technology and captured somebody's image and did a biometric analysis of it, unless they matched that person against their wanted list, they never got to find out who that person was. They never got to find out name or address or other identifying details. So they weren't processing personal data. And what the court said was that what the police were doing enabled them to single somebody out and treat them in a particular way. That's to say, to take their own image and see if that image matched a wanted list. And that was sufficient for it to be a processing of personal data. It didn't matter that they never got to know, oh, that person is Mr. Smith of 12 Acacia Avenue. So we're into data protection, and not only that, we're into the law enforcement provisions about data protection, and the court considered, because this involved the processing of biometric personal data, we were into a requirement of strict necessity to justify the processing for policing purposes. But it's very interesting to see what they say strict necessity means. It does not mean that unless the police do this, there will be a complete collapse of civil order in South Wales. It means more that the court is going to apply what in other contexts might be described as a heightened standard of scrutiny, that they're going to look particularly carefully for a robust justification for policing purposes for the processing. And in this case, they found that the requisite justification was made out. There's also a bit of discussion of something that's caused difficulty to data controllers under the new Data Protection Act 2018 regime, which is the requirement for sensitive forms of data processing that you should have an appropriate policy document. And you'll recall that's a requirement, that's an additional safeguard that slipped into the 2018 Act. It's not in the GDPR. And people often say, well, what does an appropriate policy document look like? And it's quite a difficult question to answer in the absence of either a detailed description in the statute or detailed ICO guidance. The court in the South Wales case thought that the appropriate policy document that the South Wales Police relied on was pretty thin, but on the other hand, given that this was a novel requirement and given the shortage of guidance about it, they weren't prepared to invalidate what the South Wales Police had done on that basis. So the overall conclusion is that both under Article 8 and under data protection law, what the South Wales Police had done was lawful. I think while the case doesn't break any new grounds in terms of principle, I think it's an extremely interesting case study of the court working through how you apply this legal framework when somebody is doing something novel in terms of technology. And of course, facial recognition technology is widely discussed, and I'm sure this will be the first of many cases about it. I understand, or at least this is what the court said, that it's not just the first judgment in this country about this technology, but it's the first judgment anywhere in the world. A quick reference to a recent case in the CGEU, the Fashion ID case, part of the court working through its backlog of data protection cases under the old law, the directive pre-GDPR. Again, factually rather remote from anything that a local authority would do, but relevant in terms of principles. It involved the case of an online website that had a plug-in from a social media site. And the important point is that both the retailer that ran the website and the social media company were both data controllers, not joint data controllers, but on a kind of relay race basis. So there's one bit of processing that the online retailer is responsible for, and then there's another bit where the social media company in effect takes over. The message I take from that is that sometimes, for example, when one's looking at the relationship between a local authority and a service provider that deals with individuals and provides services for individuals that are paid for by the authority, sometimes you're trying to work out, well, who's the data controller here? Is it the local authority? Is it the service provider? Is it both? And I think in many cases the answer will be you have to break down the processing of personal data into different stages. And the local authority may be data controller for some stages, and then the service provider may be data controller for others. Something I've headed up boring but important question mark. It is, of course, not boring because nothing in this area is boring. But this is a procedural change in relation to the way that we deal with data protection claims. All of them, when they're issued after the 1st of October this year, will have to be issued in the media and communications list of the High Court. And there's a new part 53 of the CPR and some accompanying practice directions which will deal with that. So at any rate, when the High Court is dealing with data protection, the likelihood in future is that those claims will come in front of a specialist judge with experience of data protection law. That doesn't prevent claims being started in the county court or transferred to the county court. So it's an interesting development as to what it says about the development of data protection case law from the future. What it may mean, fingers crossed, is that we get a higher standard of decision making in the High Court because we get a more expert cohort in the judiciary dealing with those claims. Now, finally, what about the Freedom of Information Act? I think there's been a bit of a sea change in the presentations that one makes about information law. because a few years ago, it was very much focused on freedom of information and to some extent environmental information. And I think over the last few years, and particularly post-GDPR, the data protection component has become more and more important. And I think one of the reasons for that is we've had the freedom of information legislation in force now for getting on for a decade, and a lot of the questions of principle have, if not been settled, then at least there's some authority about them. But just to make it clear that I haven't forgotten that FOIA exists, a couple of references to recent cases in the upper tribunal. First of all, the Halpin case about the personal data exemption from disclosure under FOIA. And the tribunal had erred in failing to look at the possibility of wider disclosure beyond the requester. So in data protection cases, as in other cases under FOIA, basic FOIA principle, when you disclose information, you are in effect disclosing it to the world at large, putting it into the public domain. It's not enough to say, well, there's no reason to think that this requester would do anything harmful with the data. And secondly, a somewhat grumpy decision of Judge Jacobs in the upper tribunal about first-tier tribunal decisions. In that case, he felt that what he was being asked to do was in effect to mark the first-tier tribunal's homework by explaining that it had gone wrong in a way that didn't directly affect the outcome of the case. And he was asked to do that exercise because it was said to him, well, FTT decisions are widely relied on as in effect a source of precedent. And he said, well, if they're being relied on in that way, they shouldn't be. So he was skeptical of the precedential value of first-tier tribunal decisions. We all know they're not binding precedents, but what he was saying was, even when it comes to using them as a source of guidance, they're of limited value. Well, it's all very well to say that in theory. I think when it comes to practitioners in the FOIA area, there's still not enough upper tribunal case law or case law from the higher courts for us to say, well, we'll just look at that. So in reality, you tend to end up looking at both FTT decisions and ICO decision notices to have some sort of a handle on how FOIA requests should be dealt with in a particular subject. So although Judge Jacobs is being a little bit skeptical there of the wider value of FTT decisions, I'm skeptical in turn as to whether that will have a lot of impact on the use that's made of them. So that is a quick overview of some recent developments in the information law field. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more details, please visit 11kbw.com.